Hi there, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Cloud-Based Mayhem. I am on the road, and so we're going to do an Ask Me Anything show. Before we get to that, just got back from a couple days. I'm in Austin now, but I was just over in Olathe, Kansas, which I hadn't been to Kansas many times before, to visit Garmin HQ. It was kind of like being, Brody Levin was there, one of the other Garmin athletes, and he kept saying, man, this place is like being in NASA. Neither one of us have been to NASA, but I would agree, it's just massive complex. It's like an entire city block, or maybe several put together. There's over 4,000 people there making things like the InReach and the Phoenix 5X, which I just got, and all the other just really cool devices in the marine, in aeronautics, in the outdoor. They make a lot of really amazing things that I wasn't even aware of. So some very brilliant people making cool stuff that makes our lives better. One of the other things I got was the new Phoenix 5X was with pulse ox, but actually one of the, which is super cool. I haven't been able to try that, but it's also got just all kinds of other amazing things. It's got routing, it's got topo maps. You know, so I can imagine, like in the X Alps, you know, if my phone goes down like I did last time, you know, I lost it for a brief period of time, which was really stressful. You know, having that backup control, it's got music, you know, you can download MP3 stuff to it, you know, you can pay with it. They've got their own payment platforms, kind of like Apple Pay. Pretty amazing little computer that's a watch that's on your wrist. So some really cool stuff there. And then the other thing we got to play with was their 360 camera. A lot of people don't know about the camera technology at Garmin. You know, they've got these, you know, they've got the Verb, which is basically a competitor of GoPro. Obviously GoPro owns that space. I was with GoPro for a long time. The Verb is just a vastly superior camera. It works better, it functions better, that doesn't glitch out on you all the time. You always know when it's on versus off, so you're not missing footage like I constantly did with the GoPro. So shout out to them for making just a way better camera. So if you're in the market for a, you know, little POV camera, then or an action sports camera, a wide angle like a GoPro, definitely look at that Verb. And then keep your eye out for the 360. It has been out for a while. None of us have had one, but we're getting one soon. Crazy. We're just doing demos with that in the office. It is unbelievable. And they've got this editing platform. It's just going to change the way we look at it. Video. So keep an eye out for that as well. That's pretty exciting stuff. I promise this isn't a commercial for Garmin. I'm just kind of blown away. But the new InReach Mini, which is like four times smaller than the Explorer, you know, if you don't need the maps on the device, of course, because it's so much smaller, you know, they had to cut some things out, but paired with the EarthMate app, it's basically the same thing. You have all the same stuff, same functionality. It's quite a bit cheaper, obviously, for those of you concerned about weight and size. It's just amazing, incredible little device. But you can also do everything, you know, that you can with your phone, basically with your watch. When it's paired to it, you can use the SOS. Those of you who have heard me talk about Trey's rescue, one of the things that went down there was that his InReach was, he couldn't access it after his crash, and that changed how a lot of us, where we carry things, either on our shoulder or on our flight deck. You know, it should never be in your pack. And so that's pretty neat. If it isn't a place where you can't access it, if you've got a watch on, then now you can. So pretty cool to see how all these devices in the whole Garmin range, you know, speak the same language and they all tie to one another. And yeah, it's just some very cool technology. So shout out to those guys. That was really fun. They're certainly helping my own performance and my own lifestyle improve, and just making us all safer. So really cool to be a part of that crew. And just another shout out to you all to make sure you're flying with the InReach. But yeah, this show, I'm going to break it up into a few different pieces. We're going to do the Ask Me Anything. So I put out a thing a couple weeks ago on the social medias and newsletter to just all of you to ask me questions. So I've picked out the ones that I think you'll get the most from. And we'll get into that in a bit. And I also had some time here. A few weeks back, I recorded, a lot of people have been asking me about the foot launch record that I set back in 2013. It was right after I moved to Sun Valley. We made it. I made it through another season. Can't believe it with all the people pushing so hard on that thing. But it looks like that'll stand for another year now. So, but a lot of people hadn't really heard that story. And it's kind of a fun one. There was certainly a lot of wind. It was one of the reasons I was able to go so far. But I was in big mountains the whole way. And at times it was pretty scary and some good takeaways. So once I stop talking with this preamble in the beginning, we'll replay that for you. The sound's going to be a little different because I recorded that back in my little podcast studio at home, and now I'm on the road in the hotel, so it's probably a little more echoey now. But we'll play that, and then we'll get into the Ask Me Anything. But just before we do, I'm getting lots of emails from people that just, you know, thank me for the podcast because it makes them safer and it helps them from making bad decisions. I want to share with you a really bad decision that I recently made that was just like a kind of a wake-up call. So my real serious ex-ops training started here about a week and a half ago. So we've got a little over 9 months until the race starts. And so Ben and I decided to get going on it. And a couple of the days were hikes up Baldy, which is my local site in Sun Valley. It's about 1,000 meters vertical. And then just fly down, you know, super mellow, early morning, you know, typically nothing goes wrong, just sledders. And so the second one of those that I did, I always fly with my inReach no matter where I go, and I always have the tracking on. And this was after, you know, the chairlifts have closed down. There's nobody on the mountain. You know, there's some maintenance and stuff going on, but, you know, it's super early in the morning. I'm by myself. I have this beautiful hike up. I'm pushing really hard. I get to the top and I unpack and realize I don't have my inReach. And it was actually conscious. I mean, it was sitting on my seat in the van at the bottom. And I thought, oh, I don't need that. I'm just going up to do a quick hike and fly. And I thought to myself, like, okay, that's like the last day, you know, when this is like the classic when you're on the ski hill, it's always the last run of the day where you get hurt, where you're like nonchalant. Maybe you've had a beer and I've been skiing all day, and then pap, you blow a knee. But flying is not typically blowing a knee. So one of the common themes I hope you guys are all hearing again and again and again is this one flight you make is the most important of your life. We have to approach this sport like wingsuiters approach their jumps. And this one could be the one. And that one could be the one. It wasn't. You know, I flew. It was totally benign. It was really fun. It was a beautiful day and nothing happened. But it could have. You know, I could have blown a launch. I could have hit some weird air. You know, in the morning, you get a bunch of catabatic air and stuff. And there's nobody up there. There's nobody. You know, I didn't have a radio. I didn't have a way to communicate. I had my phone, but there's even up there, there's really poor cell reception. So just a reminder, friendly reminder out there that every flight you take is the most important flight you'll ever take. So don't be stupid like I was, and you know, use those, have those devices. And that's yet another kind of pump up here for the inReach. Getting a little bit tired of people saying, oh, well, you know, I got my spot, you know, at least people know where you are. Yeah, but you can't communicate with it. You know, there's nothing, there's no two-way, there's no back and forth. There's a million reasons why when that comes into play, you know, imagine, you know, not having a phone, not having a way to communicate what's wrong, what you need. I mean, spot's better than nothing, but not by much. So do yourself a favor. If you fly, get an inReach. So there you go. I won't say anything more about that. Next, we've got on our store in the Cloudbase Mayhem, we just got a whole new shipment of new Patagonia stuff, some really cool different shades of blue in both women's and men's. So a great way to support the show, and I'll do my whole support thing at the end. That's not for right now, but just go to Cloudbase Mayhem and check that out. We've got some new stuff there, some new Patagonia stuff. It's beautiful. People are really digging it, and that's a great way to support it as, you know, add some swag to your collection. Finally, when I was over in Macedonia at the end of last month, I forgot my book that I was reading. And so I got on Audible and got Stephen Kotler's Rise of the Supermans, or Rise of Superman or something. I forget the title exactly, but a lot of people have been telling me to read this, and I've been super interested in flow state. Mihai Csikszentmihalyi that, you know, started that whole revolution all those years back, and the show with Adele Haunte kind of sparked my new vigor and learning more about it. To be honest, like the first 80% of the book is mostly stories that I, you know, really knew. So, you know, like Dean Potter and Laird Hamilton and, you know, people that are really pushing the kind of adventure action end of things. And, but what got really interesting at the end was just, you know, the technicalities of flow and how you find it and what it means and also the dangers of it. And one of the things that a question I often get is like, why is paragliding so addicting? You know, my girlfriend was asking me this the other day, and she's like, why do you all seem so crazy about this, as opposed to running or golf or something else? I mean, we all get addicted to our sports, but I was thinking about that, and I thought, God, does that have something to do with flow? And so I'm just putting this out there, you know, curious to you all, and, you know, please get back to me on this. But I think that one of the things that is so just unavoidable in this sport, and the thing that the reason we pursue it so tenaciously and we can't get away from it, and the reason it's so addicting is because it's such an easy door to pass through and to get into flow. And you find out all the reasons, you know, why that can be difficult and stuff in the book, but also the downsides and the dangers of it. You know, all those people, Shane McConkey's a big player in that book. And, you know, obviously we know where Shane went, we know where Dean went. It also talks really starkly and honestly about the dangers of flow. And, I think that's something that we don't hear and talk about much in this sport. And it's certainly a big reason. You know, I think about this when it comes to like things like the X Alps and some of the risks that I personally take. And I think a lot of that is just because, you know, it's so easy to get in the flow when you paraglide because there's nothing else you can focus. That's what we all love about it, is when we're flying, you know, all the other messy stuff in life just vanishes. It's gone. So we're kind of automatically catapulted into this flow state. And so then when we're not flying, all that messy stuff is more messy because we know we can just escape it and go flying again. And so, and there's some very real dangers to that. So I don't have a solution. I just wanted to put that out there that I'm kind of enjoying exploring all this and would love to hear from you all what your take is on that and what your own experiences are. So please let me know. And so now we're going to break here into the story about the big flight I did 240 miles from here in Sun Valley back in 2013. So it looks like that record's now going to hold for another year. So that's been 6 years ago. I'm super surprised at that because there's the whole Utah crew down in there flying Lab and Porcupine that is certainly set up much better in most ways for going big because you're flying right down a freeway and you don't have a bunch of mountains, so you can fly in quite a bit more wind. But their season seems to be, you know, kicking off quite a bit later, so they're not getting nearly the sun. I'm sure we just haven't identified other sites. Revis got, you know, had a couple huge ones around at Pine this year. So cool to see people pushing it really hard. So I have no doubt that record isn't going to hold up for much longer. And, you know, I'd love to, of course, break it myself. But I hope you enjoy this story about that flight. And then when that's done, it's about 20 minutes. And so if you know the story, just fast forward now about 20 minutes. And when that's done, we'll get into these questions that came in for this Ask Me Anything show, which is convenient because I'm on the road and kind of hard to line up interviews. So I hope you get something out of that as well. A lot of people have been asking, you know, just how it happened, what happened, and why is it held? I think, you know, it inevitably, like all records, it will fall for sure. What was kind of cool about this one was that it happened in pretty big mountains. You know, it wasn't a flatland flight by any stretch. Across six big ranges on the way out of here. It was from my home site in Sun Valley. And so a little bit of the lead up to that, it was an amazing week. It was the record went down July 15th, which is kind of when it tends to be super strong here in Sun Valley in the Rockies. And but it was an amazing week for me. The week before it went down, I had my personal best. I was out flying with Nate Scales and flew into kind of like West Yellowstone. So that's over our mountain range, which is the Pioneers. And then the next one, which is the Big Lost, which is kind of the main spine of the Rockies, Rocky Mountain Trench. and then over the Lemhi's, and then over the Beaverheads, which is the border on the Continental Divide with Montana. And then we kind of got pushed a little bit further south and went 256K out into Wyoming, which was wicked special. That was amazing. So on a big high from that. And then 6 days later, tapped into another really good day. And that one, we were kind of going more to the north. So crossed all those same ranges. And at the end of the day, ended up in the Tobaccos. And I'd run out of oxygen at that point. And it was a really high day. So we were often, 16 to 18,000 feet. And that was my kind of first major brush with hypoxia. At one point, I was a little bit out ahead in front of Nate, and I called him on the radio, and I had a full face helmet on and a visor. And I had learned that, if I had my visor down when I was on the radio, it didn't sound, it didn't sound very good. So anyway, I called Nate, and he radioed back, and he's like, "Dude, you sound like an idiot. What's wrong?" And I was like, "Oh, my visor must be down." So I reached up to put my visor down, and it was up. So, and it's totally black visor. So I should have actually noticed that the visor was down. And so anyway, I left it, and I called him back, and I tried to really slow down, "Hi, Gavin," or "Hi, Nate, this is Gavin, what's your 20? And he radioed back again and was like, "Dude, you sound like a 4-year-old. What is wrong with you?" And anyway, I looked down at my instruments, and I was like 17,500 feet, super tall. And I had run out of oxygen at that point. It was a pretty long flight. It was like 8-9 hours or something. And this was kind of near the end. And I realized that I had been flying for like 40K with no idea that I was flying a paraglider. I was just kind of like looking at trees and looking at birds. And there was this big mine down below me and the Tobaccos. And I was kind of checking that out. I'm like, wow. I mean, I wasn't sick or it wasn't necessarily giddy or anything. I mean, I felt fine, but I was obviously not in the right frame of mind. So dialed down a couple thousand feet, and that cleared it up pretty quickly. Not totally, but then I called him again, and he's like, "Oh, no, now you sound like a human. Hey, here's where I am." And so anyway, we landed that day, and that was 319K. So that was, again, by a big jump, like 70K, a personal best again. A good friend of ours came and picked me up that day, Mike Fow, and we drove home and, got home at like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. I was still kind of on high from the flight. And so I didn't sleep much. And then the next morning he was driving me home because he lives down in Haley, which is like 12 miles down the road. And as I was driving through town, I was expecting to just go to bed, and I was pretty tired. And I got a call from Matt Beechner, local pilot here, a really good friend of mine and total Jedi. And he and Mitch Riley were getting ready to launch. And he's like, "Dude, I think today's even better than yesterday." So I was like, "Oh shit, I gotta go flying again." So I borrowed a can of oxygen from, or a bottle of oxygen from Mike, and went across the street, got a sandwich, and raced up the gondola. And by the time I got to the top, Matt and Mitch had already launched about a half an hour before. And so I was hurrying as much as I could. I finally got off the hill a little after 11, which is late here. We have kind of a southeast start, and that's one of the special things about Sun Valley is you can start early. And so I launched, and they got unlucky. Our first move is kind of getting up high and then crossing our valley and getting onto this kind of Sun Peak Ridge and start heading towards Montana and get over this big pass, this mountain called Otto's between the kind of the south end of the Boulder Range here locally. And they flew into a whole bunch of cloud. There was a bunch of high cloud that day, and it was definitely going to be a day that was overdevelopment was a big risk. And there was quite a bit of cirrus and some other stuff, and it just wasn't really on yet. So they both got kind of unlucky and bombed. And so as I came over their head, half an hour later, the clouds had cleared off, and it was definitely super on. In fact, so on that by the time I got up to the pass, I was really fighting to stay below 18,000, try to stay legal with the flight. And the sky was already getting pretty big. And so I got a call on the radio from Matt, and he's like, "Hey dude, I'll chase you." And I thought, okay, cool. I mean, I might go 50 or 60K or something. I think this overdevelopment's going to get me. And maybe another half an hour, 45 minutes later, I was having to struggle really hard to stay below 18,000, like constantly spiraling down. And there was a lot of wind, quite a bit more wind than I had ever flown in. And as I got across the Big Lost Range, I was kind of getting out into, better looking skies. There was quite a bit of Virga behind me at that point, kind of drop it out, but it was quite a bit to my south. And it was just smooth, amazing. And I was hitting 110. At one point, I saw 120 kilometers an hour on my glide speed. So, you know, dealing with quite heavy winds, you know, 50, maybe even 60 K an hour up at top of lift, which is a lot. And what was special about that day is there was a ton of wind up high. And it was layered a bit. There wasn't as much down near the ground, but there was also way too much on the ground. And I got to feel that firsthand as I dove into the limb highs. So that's the second range we got across. No, actually the third, I guess, going across. And then the next one after that is the divide and going into Montana. So as I came into the limb highs, I was really tall, leaving the Big Lost. And it's about a 15-mile glide across the valley to get into the limb highs. And then the limb highs, they're quite a thick range. And as I got into them, you know, it was smoking up high, but as I got down lower, kind of, I was down at like 11,500, 12,000. So I was basically just at peak height coming into the limb highs, and I turned into the wind and I didn't have any forward penetration at all. And I thought, oh man, I mean, it was totally on the right side of things and it was sunny and, you know, I knew there'd be a climb, but I was losing the battle. I was getting lower and, you know, kind of getting back closer to the terrain. And, you know, our terrain is not really terrain you want to be in super tight on it when it's ripping midsummer in July. So while I still had some height, I just went over the back and kind of just got pretty handsy in the brakes, pretty hold on the brakes, knowing it was I was just flying directly into really strong rotor, strong lee side, not recommended. And then it got wicked hairy. There were two points in this flight where I got really low, and this was the first one. And so, and I basically just trying to keep the glider open as I got pushed further and further back behind this mountain range, kind of down into this canyon that was really treed. And down in the canyon, at one point, there was another ridge that kind of went more north-south again. So the winds that day were very strong, kind of west-southwest. And so more, you know, so I could kind of almost like ridge soar this thing, but I was down, but I was behind these big mountains. So it was incredibly rough. And I just kept trying to find a place that I could top land. I didn't want to get blown over another ridge. And so I was basically kind of down in these trees, and there was a few little openings that I was trying to figure out how I could, you know, squeak into them and not get totally rotored by the trees in front and lose the wing, and also just land and deal with the winds. And at that point, you could see the winds just ripping up this slope. And I was proper scared. It was pretty nerve wracking. And so a few times I got actually below tree height. So, you know, well below 100 feet. And when you look at the track log, I think there's a couple times where I'm like 15 meters off the ground. And then this eagle came out of a tree and just went, he didn't even have to turn. Like, he wasn't even thermally. He just went poof. And so I went over to him thinking like, okay, well, maybe my best move actually is to get high here again and get out of this. And as I went over to him, I got a big cravat on the left side of the glider. I mean, it was totally manageable, but it was just, you know, it was not a cravat really. It was just a big tuck. And it kind of locked in. And so the glider was not wicked stable. And so I got into that and just went, okay, I'll just turn towards the cravatted side, because the climb was like 8 up easy and on the averager. So I got back into that, went immediately back to 16,000 feet where it got nice and smooth again. And then the next kind of 150, almost 200 K was just cloud hopping. It was one of those days where you're just perfectly in sync. Amazing. Just every time I'd leave a cloud and start going downwind, and again, you know, I'm going 90, 100 K an hour, you know, a cloud would appear right before me. So it was, again, just kind of fighting to stay below 18,000. So I'd be leaving these climbs at kind of 16, 16.5 and keep going. Beautiful. And then as I got over the Beaver Heads, had another kind of major incident. I was on the Nivik Peak 3 then, really nice, very mellow two-liner. And I think being super tired from the day before was really helping me, because it was quite spicy conditions. But I was just kind of like in this relaxed, you know, exhausted mode really. So I wasn't really overreacting to things. I think that was really helping, that I was just being calm, I guess. Anyway, got on again on the lee side, on the backside of the Beaver Heads, and had a big blowout that was no big deal at all. You know, got it back under control pretty quick, kept going. Then got over Butte, Montana, which is a big Superfund site, very ugly and tons of mining. And as I went in there, I was like at 18 grand. And then I went from like 18 grand to right on the deck in no time. It got really shaded out. And I just got on a bad line and got down on this ridge. And when I got to the ridge, I looked at my my instrument and I was 319K. I was exactly the distance that I'd been the day before. I was like, you got to be kidding me, all this work. But it was only, I don't know, at that point, maybe 5:30, 5:45 p.m. And like, there was a lot of day left. And I thought, God, I have got to get out of here. All I got to do to beat the record, at that point was Nick Greese's, and he had gone 204 miles. So I think that's like 330K. I mean, I was really close, or maybe 335K. It was pretty close. So all I had to do was kind of get up off this ridge and wing it off downwind, and I'd probably have it. And so anyway, Richard, and it was pretty rough, but it wasn't lee side like the other time had been. It wasn't as stressful, and there was just no sun. It was just completely clouded out. This Virga and all this, you know, this big line of clouds that I'd been running from all day had finally caught up. And then this little pocket of sun came out, just this little thing. And as soon as it did, pow, just right back up to base. Huge, strong, very fast climb. And I got back up to base again and started running off again downwind and looking at my instruments and, you know, 340 and 350. It's like, oh my God, I got this. I got the record. But at the same time, I'm looking back over my shoulder, looking at this line of really nasty looking stuff. And I was like, man, I don't think I can push this too much longer. That's going to gobble me up. You know, I think there was so much wind that day, I was able to stay out in front of it, but it was at that point, it was catching up. So I wasn't really confident that I could stay out in front of this thing. And as I left the end of that range, and then at that point, you're really out into the flats in Montana, and there were still cloud streets. Obviously, it was still working out in front of me. At that point, it was only 6:20, 6:30. There were still 2, maybe even 3 hours in the middle of summer like that, where that you could keep flying. But there was this massive lake in front of me, Canyon Fury Lake, which is just south of Helena, Montana. And as I got out there, it was really clear that I didn't have the height to get over the lake, and you could see big white caps and stuff on the lake. And I was like, yeah, maybe I should call it. And I was trying to fly slow. I was trying to find another climb, but they were just totally washed out. There was no terrain there to have any kind of triggers. So I had to dial down out of the sky before I got too committed to going over the lake and landing in the water. And landed at this little kind of like Forest Service boat ramp campsite thing. And there was all these people at the campsite. And so as I was coming in, I was kind of showing off and doing some wing overs and stuff, and obviously really happy knowing that I'd gotten the record. So it was 387 Ks from launch. So that was super exciting, about 240 miles and way further than I had ever flown, of course, and landed and, you know, kind of expecting like you normally do that people would come over and be like, oh, well, you know, what's that all about? And nobody did. Nobody came over. They were all, you know, I could see all these people, but they didn't come over. So anyway, I started packing up, and about an hour later, Matt came screaming in. He'd been driving 100 miles an hour all day, and he was still, you know, an hour or two behind me. And so we were hugging and really excited and couldn't wait to get some beers and celebrate. And finally, a couple of these people that were at this camp came over, and they were all mental health patients from Helena, which is the capital of Montana. It was just, you know, just north of there a little ways. And they were having like a kind of a barbecue. And so one of them who had, you know, he was talking about how he'd been in jail a bunch of times. And he was, needless to say, very entertaining guy. He invited me to come over for a burger. And so I went over and I met all these folks. And, you know, it was kind of the wide gamut of like, you know, totally unresponsive. I'm just kind of nodding their heads to, you know, to like this guy who was pretty fun, but just obviously pretty whacked out. And so he started cooking a burger, and to keep the flames alive, he kept putting a bunch of the plastic wrappers that had all these burgers in, like underneath, into the fire. Just watching all this black smoke seep into my burger. Okay, it'd be too rude not to eat this thing, but probably got a little bit of semi-cancer from it. But anyway, so that's the story of the big flight. They were awfully kind to me, had a nice burger, and then Matt showed up, and we went and had some beers and found this little it was German death metal karaoke bar that night. It was like a Monday night, so nothing was open except this one place, which was a really interesting evening watching death metal karaoke in Butte, Montana. And then I think it was like a 16-hour drive home. So it was a 7.5-hour flight out there by paraglider and 16 hours drive home, which I'll always be thankful for Matt doing. It was a big day that he didn't know he was committing to that when he said, yeah, man, I'll chase you. So, Yeah, and that happened in 2013. So now, days are getting pretty short. And so I think that it's pretty safe that'll hold for another year. At some point here, it's going to get broken for sure. But very special day and awfully big terrain. And, it made me realize that I think there's, much bigger flights to be done here, but a better day where you've got more hours and less wind. So it's not so scary. I don't really like flying in those conditions anymore. Back then I was a little bit more dumb and willing to put up with that kind of stuff, but it's it's not something I would recommend for sure. But anyway, I hope you enjoyed that. People have been asking me for that story, so there you go. So now for these questions. There's not a ton. Not a ton came through, but some of them are going to take a little bit of time to answer, so I hope you find this valuable. Nick Hawks, who's been on the show a couple times, has a whole bunch of questions. I'll just take these one at a time. How many different sites do you fly in a season? That depends a lot on the season. Of course, if it's an X-Alps year, just the race itself is going to be dozens and dozens and dozens, but I try to move around a lot. I learned this right when I learned. I got my P2 down in through Superfly with Chris Santa Croce and Jeff Farrell down in Utah back in 2006, I think it was. And we immediately went on the road, got the P2, and I was with some other people that were much better pilots, been flying along a lot longer than I had. And we went out to California, we went out to Marshall, and then worked our way up the coast. And I just thought that was super thrilling. I mean, these were all established sites, and that was really exciting because, you're constantly, some of them were ridge soaring sites and some of them were mountain sites, and I was really new. So, of course, everything was really exciting. But I think what I learned from that, and we ended up in Seattle up at Tiger, and Tiger's a site where a ton of people fly, and they're famous up there for having not very good ground handling skills, as opposed to the folks out in Utah that fly in all that wind at the point all the time, and it just seemed like the easy solution to becoming a better pilot was to fly a lot of different sites, so you're getting a little bit of everything, and so that has, that has transpired, I think, it can transpire into very fast learning. So yeah, I would encourage everybody to fly as many possible sites as you can. The other thing that's kind of interesting about comps is comps are almost never won by the local hero. They're usually won by people that have never flown there. And so that's the obvious, the obvious conclusion there is that, when you fly your home site, you get kind of stuck into what everybody does. There's the house thermal, and then you go here, and then you go there, and then you go, but when you go with fresh eyes, you can just, ignorance is bliss. You don't know what should be done. You just do what the time of the day and the sun angle and all the things we learn about paragliding dictate you do. And often you can crush out some pretty interesting stuff doing it that way. So I highly encourage flying new sites. And that leads into the next question. When you get to a new site, do you have a system for assessing it, or do you just go on feel? Both. So, and it again depends on what kind of time you have and that kind of thing. In the X-Alps, I'm totally reliant on my team, and they're looking at the weather, and I'll get up to a launch and it might be, definitely not a recreational day, and I've got to figure out if I've got the skills to make it work. It might be really cross, it might be cycling really hard, it might be about to overdevelop, and I've got to make that call. But in more of a recreational situation, then, certainly your assessment should be similar every day in terms of, if you have access to good weather information, you already know before you even step out of the car or onto the hike that if it's, what kind of day is, should transpire by, you've already got all the weather skills to know that. There's some good warnings in the podcast with Hansa talking about, you might be on a windward side flying site where you think it's windward and you're actually in the lee of something because you don't have the local knowledge, you don't have the resources. So whenever you possibly can, of course, you want to use locals' knowledge, but, we also have kind of a, I think all the pilots in the X-Alps, we all are really, really wary of local information because, they're talking about, they're, their knowledge is not, it doesn't necessarily tie in very well with what we're experiencing in the X Alps. You know, we've got to make it work on dicey days. So, you know, they might be like, nah, that's not going to work. You should keep walking or that kind of thing. And you just, you know, you kind of have to just, oh, thank you very much for the information and keep going and kind of do your thing. So, but typically, you know, your assessment should be on the medio side of things. And then of course, when you get up there, you know, what do you see? What do you feel? And be really wary of how, maybe if there are others there, how they're influencing you. So, you know, Bruce and I used to show up at Fiche, which is a really famous site. You guys have heard me talk about this before on the website, but I mean, on the podcast, but we would show up at really, you know, popular sites in the Alps, and it would just be he and I. And, you know, that's a warning. If it's just you sitting up there and you're a really popular site, for whatever reason, the piloting community has decided that this is a super dicey day. So that's, you know, that should be a warning. But and there are other times where a lot of people will be, you know, you'll hear the whole like ground suck mentality. And, you know, if you feel like it's a totally reasonable day and you've got the skills to handle it, then, you know, that might be a good time to ignore some of that. So it really depends on your hours, depends on your skill level. It depends on where you are personally that day and, you know, how your own awareness is. And eventually it's just that. There's also, I've just been reading that Thinking Fast and Slow by Kahneman, and he talks about that like gut feel. There's now science that proves that that's not just a gut feel. You know, there's all kinds of things that are going into that. And so, you know, if your gut feel is bad, listen to it. If your gut feel is good, listen to it. So that's kind of how I assess a new site. But I think there's nothing more thrilling in our sport than finding new places to fly and launching a place for the first time, even if it's, you know, Annecy, a place that millions of people have launched, but it's new for you. So highly encourage you to do it. Next question. What's the longest amount of time per season you don't fly? Like i.e. 60 days between flights in the winter. So 60 days would be highly unusual for me to go that long. I did before the last, before the 2017 race because I'd blown my shoulder out mountain biking. So I went, you know, 4 months without flying. And that was hard actually to start flying again. But usually, you know, I'll try to at least ground handle, you know, pretty regularly. And, you know, very often I go a month, but not very often more than that. And then, and what's the longest time you can go without flying and still come back and feel comfortable? I can feel uncomfortable after a week of not flying, you know, feel pretty rusty just after that much time. But certainly in the spring is when I'm definitely trying to be the most heads up, because then I recognize that I truly am rusty. And, you know, any flying I've done in the winter has either been, you know, at a comp for a week or something, but it's mostly just sledders and little hike and flies and not really getting too much thermal flying. And so, and then the spring can tend to be pretty boisterous and sharp. And so that's a time where I'm really trying to be much more heads up and try not to scratch out low. I try to always have tons of altitude. I try to make much more conservative decisions after I'm rusty. But the other thing too is I just find that my head is not in the greatest place, and I'm a little bit more scared. I'm a little more herky jerky, and so I try to just, you know, own that and be like, hey, you know, that's part of what's great about the sport. That's part of, you know, that's just dealing. And you know, you've got to just breathe and relax. And, you know, if it's not your day, it's not your day. What is the improvement in paragliders you're most excited about in the next 5 years? I'm not very technical, and I don't, you know, I'm always just blown away with what they're constantly doing. Of course, I'm excited about, you know, it seems like the safety is constantly going up and the performance is constantly going up. you know, the CCC thing seems to be working out. So at the competition end of things, super excited to see more players in that space, and the limits that they've imposed on speed and stuff seem to be working. It's encouraging these other companies to, you know, get back into a space that typically has required a lot of money and not a lot of return. So, you know, UP is back in, Niviq's back in, 777's back in, Flow is back in. So that's really exciting to see. What I'm a little bit worried about is the, you know, Russ Ogden talked about this in his podcast, one of the designers for Ozone and test pilots for Ozone. You know, what I'm worried about is, you know, 15 years ago, the top end of, you know, acceptable conditions was like 15K in the mountains, just because the gliders were so much slower, you know. So, and so even though wings have gotten much safer, especially with shark nose technology in the last few years, they just keep getting better. The accidents are, you know, still as bad. I mean, you know, there's still as many accidents as there was. And so, I mean, I don't have the exact statistics on that, but that's just what I'm hearing. And so, and what Russ pointed out was that, you know, the better wings are allowing us to just fly in more wind, and wind is still dangerous. So, you know, is that just going to keep happening? Are they going to keep getting better glide, you know, better glide ratios, and that just allows people to fly in more wind? That's kind of a negative, I guess, if there is a negative of wings getting better. Better reserve system. So he lists out a whole bunch of things. What are you excited about? Faster wings, safer wings, better reserve systems, better electronics, mapping, planning. Two things there that I could grab. So better reserve systems, you know, the acro crew, the acro side of things with the cutaways and steerable reserves. It was brought to my attention this year that, you know, one of the negatives of throwing a Regalo steerable reserve with when you don't have a cutaway is that those two wings will very likely work against one another. So you've got the Regalo that you can steer, but if you haven't disabled your main wing, which if you throw low is pretty hard to do. So if you throw low, you know, it's most likely you're just going to be coming down under the two. So your reserve and your main wing hopefully is all screwed up, and so it's not affecting the other one very much. But if it is, you're going to be coming under a downplane situation pretty hard. And so it's inevitable, I think, that we're going to be moving to what acro pilots are using commonly now, which is the whole cutaway system. Still a little bit heavy for the XC side of things, although definitely not in the competition side because we don't care about weight at all then. So I'm surprised we're not seeing this more in the XC side of things, certainly at the comp end. And I hope we start seeing it in lightweight. And I hope we just start seeing it everywhere because it's definitely the way forward. Better electronics. So as I said at the top of the show, I just got back from Garmin. I mean, imagine an inReach like the Explorer. So this wouldn't be a mini, but imagine that being also voice capable and also radio capable. There was all kinds of situations we talked about there with some of the other athletes that were there, or ambassadors, about, you know, climbers and wingsuit jumpers and that kind of thing, where, or imagine it being also an avalanche beacon, you know, like all things in one. So I'm really excited about that. I mean, I think that that's where that's moving. I think a lot of people don't understand why the plans for, you know, inReach, you know, the texting plans and tracking, you know, they've got all those different levels, why that's so expensive. I know why that's so expensive because I've been in the boating world for a very long time. You know, what we pay on the boat to have to bring internet connectivity, you just wouldn't believe. It's like one of our biggest line items every year. It's we pay thousands of dollars every month. It's crazy. And that's because it's all either going through Inmarsat or Iridium. And so that's just what those companies charge because they got to put those big expensive satellites up in the sky. So, you know, I can't talk about the future. You know, the whole low orbit thing, I guess, didn't really work, but there's going to be things happening in that space that will bring that cost down, no doubt, but that's not somewhere where there's markup, you know, with Spot or Garmin or whoever it is. So, you know, right now, voice is just, it would just be prohibitively expensive. But, you know, there was a lot of excitement about maybe using your inReach to also send pictures and that kind of thing. And again, it's all just a matter of data. So until satellite data gets cheaper, you know, that's going to be tricky. But I'm excited about that because that would be, you know, that would make it even that much safer. You know, when you can, it's one thing to be able to two-way text. That's terrific. It's amazing. It really helped us out when Ben got hurt in May down in Nevada. But, you know, being able to talk to the, you know, being able to talk to the dispatch and all that kind of thing is just a whole nother level of safety that would be, of course, brilliant and wonderful to have. Moving on, Rodrigo Ciudad. I'm a 60 hours pilot and already had my wake up landing due to overconfidence and maybe early intermediate syndrome. Now I fly really consciously of the conditions and my own tools to avoid hitting the ground too hard. But I don't want to stay in the house thermal all day. I want to push myself to start getting farther from the takeoff while still flying safely. The short version of the question is, what do you recommend to start flying away from the safety of the usual flying spot? Gosh, I feel like this is a subject comes up a lot. I feel like we've tackled it a lot, but I still threw it in here just because I know this is a place where a lot of people are. You know, my first XC flight was down in the Dominican Republic. You know, I flew like 6K. It was like one of the most exciting things ever. I just, you know, like, oh, it just blows my mind. So Nick Reese always calls it cutting the cord. So yeah, I mean, if you're going to fly, at some point you got to cut the cord. And so, you know, in the beginning to do that, you know, what we talk about on the show all the time is, you know, first building up a foundation, you know, that foundation of ground handling, of weather, of finding a mentor, having the right gear and, you know, and of course taking it slow. But, you know, I guess probably that my best advice would be to cut the cord in you know, relatively safer places where there are other pilots you can cut it with. You know, it's pretty nice. It's kind of like having your hand held in the beginning when you leave that house thermal and try to get to the next one. You know, that's quite a bit easier to do in a place like Annecy or Marshall or, you know, a million other places that are, you know, where there are other pilots to help you out and to help give you information and be psyched for what you're doing and help you in the sky. And, you know, the other thing is to get a guide, get an instructor. You know, there are, this is the time of year where people start heading down to Mexico and Colombia and they do these, you know, week-long guided trips. They're not super expensive. You know, then you're flying with, you know, ace pilots who are super passionate and into it. You know, Rob Spore and his whole crew with Eagle Paragliding, Jockey Sanderson and Chris and those guys, they do, you know, this time of year, they're over in Bir, over in India, and, you know, these huge mountains, but it's a really, you know, pretty reasonable place to fly big mountains. And, you know, if you've got 100 hours, then that's totally doable. And you could go fly with those guys and get your first 50K or 75K or maybe even 100K. And that would blow your mind. But there's, you know, there's a lot of those operators out there that are really very good and they go to amazing places. And that covers kind of all the things that we've talked about so far, you know, assessing new sites and flying new places. And, you know, okay, it takes some time and it costs some money, but that's kind of a Tim Ferriss shortcut cheat. That's a flying hack that you could take advantage of that I would definitely recommend. Okay, next question from Stillian Blagoev. Stillian, I hope I didn't butcher your name there. Could you talk a bit about the dynamics when throwing a front mount reserve? Since it is connected to both main carabiners, I can imagine it will turn you around and it may deploy behind you. I don't really understand that, but what about landing position? Would you be able to stand up or will you land on your butt? And should you try to sort of dive under the Y bridle so you can stay upright and roll over when landing? So, and then he brings up, some of you may have seen Nick Nanens has a great video where he throws a front mount reserve. I'll put that link up in the show notes. So he recommended. I asked Nick. I didn't have time to do that this morning, but I've seen that video. He lands in a tree, so we can't really assess, you know, what the landing's like on that. So, but because I've never thrown a front mount reserve, this morning I reached out to my friend Matt Henze, a proper Jedi and instructor, and he's been doing a ton of SIV. He also hasn't, but he had some thoughts on it that I wanted to share with you. So, number one, if you just connect it to your carabiners, you know, it's pretty hard to land in an upright position. You know, it's mostly going to direct you onto your butt. So even under a reserve, or especially if you've got a downplaning situation, that is not where you want to land. You know, there was a really good article in the latest OOSHPA by Chris Santa Croce. They've got this kind of ask accident assessment thing. And he was talking about, you know, one of the accidents that they had was a pilot went in and instead of putting out his landing gear, i.e. his legs, he went ahead and let his harness take the hit, which I've done several times. And, you know, if you've got a really good harness and you're not going to hit that hard, okay, that might be okay. But almost always it's much better, as he points out, to put your landing gear down. It's better to break an ankle or break a leg than it is to break your back. And if you hit on your butt, like we saw with Ben's accident, you know, it's just that there's so much force there. And at some point, one of your vertebrae is going to blow out, and much, you know, much worse surgery, much higher consequences. You know, better to hurt a leg than it is to hurt your back. So, and if you have your landing gear out and you're really in an athletic position, you know, you can run it. You can run it out. You can do a PLF. You know, you can get rid of a lot of energy there. You can dissipate a lot of energy there. And especially with some practice, Mitch Riley talked about that, you know, being in a really athletic position when you land and, you know, being in that kind of like torpedo position that we all learn when we launch. So, yeah, I think that's pretty important. But you know, what Matt recommended is, you know, if you get a longer bridle, a lot of front mount reserves these days have like a long mesh thing that it comes in, and you can route that, you know, like you kind of do more with a normal reserve, and use a longer bridle and go ahead and route it to your shoulder mounts. I mean, all harnesses have the shoulder mounts in them. That's where reserves are supposed to be attached to. So much better to route it via the shoulder mounts. And so you don't have to, you know, you're not in that kind of difficult position of it is tricky, apparently. Like I said, I haven't done it myself, but it is pretty tricky to get in that, you know, in a good landing position. And coming down under your butt, especially if you're under a small reserve, I'll say this also about reserves. There's a huge push right now towards lightweight gear. I'm going to get into pod harnesses here in a sec, but, you know, I don't recommend saving weight unless you're like, you know, unless it's like an X-Alps or X-Pier kind of thing with your reserve. You know, you can get a lightweight one, but don't go small. You know, a lightweight one that's right at the weight that you're, you know, if you're 100 kg all up and you get 100 kg reserve, you know, if it's a round, you're going to be coming down at 6 meters a second. Six meters a second is fast. And again, that's if you have your main wing disabled. So if you don't have it disabled, you're going to be downplaning, coming down even faster. 6 meters a second is a pretty, you know, that's definitely a speed where you can break an ankle, break a leg. So, or, you know, if you come down on your butt, you might do some pretty good damage to your back. So, you know, get a bigger reserve than your weight range. And there's, you know, anyway, I won't get totally into reserves. There's many, many, many articles about reserves, but I don't feel like that's a place where saving a few ounces is a very smart decision. Next, Daniel Schmidt, for some background on him, he lives in Oberstdorf, southeast point of Germany. He has access to a lot of flying sites. He tries to spend as much time as he can under a glider. He's got about 70 hours so far. He tries to fly every week. He stepped up recently to a B-class wing, and he's done two SIVs, and he's got more scheduled. So great. That's awesome. Two SIVs at 70 hours is terrific. So I applaud that. And he wants to know about opinion and recommendations for pod harnesses for new pilots. So this is a combo answer from me and Matt. I went ahead and asked Matt about this as well, because he's doing a lot of instructing, and he does a lot of instructing of new pilots. And so Yeah, here we go. So Skywalk recently did a test in wind tunnel, and it showed that if you've got it trimmed right, in other words, if you're, you know, if you're not too far down or too far back, in other words, you've got your pod aligned correctly through the air, it can make about a point glide difference. So that's quite a bit, 6 to 1 or 7 to 1. So that's considerable. But if you don't have it right, it's almost, it's totally negligible. So first, you got to get your point of your hang points correct, and you've got to get that forward, backward, which can be pretty tricky. I'm often screwed that up. I don't really have, and you can see it when you're flying alongside somebody. If they're tipped back a little bit or they're tipped forward a little bit, then it's basically just like flying in a seat harness. So that's number one. So it does make a difference, but you got to have it right. Other obvious benefits of a pod, they are a lot warmer, so that makes a difference. Matt was not too concerned about, one of the things you hear a lot is it makes you a lot more prone to twisting. He didn't find that's much of a concern. It does make you more prone to twisting, but, with proper training and learning and that kind of thing, as soon as you have any kind of, if you're in washy wind or something, you feel like you might, the first thing we all do is put our feet down, the same position they'd be in a seat. So that kind of eliminates that. And good piloting, even intermediate piloting is pretty it's pretty easy to learn how to not twist up, by using your hands and just good piloting skills, he wasn't as concerned about that. Excuse me, just bumped my mic there. He wasn't as concerned about that as kind of what you hear, like the whole cliche stuff that you hear on the hill all the time. Oh, well, they're much, much more dangerous. He didn't find that. What he is concerned with, and this is something that Marco brought up in his podcast. If you haven't heard that one, definitely go back and check that out. Marco, I never know how to say his last name, Hergetic, that he was down in Mexico and we raced last winter together. His concern with pod harnesses, with hammock harnesses, so not pod harnesses necessarily, but the lightweight stuff, is not having a seat board. And I've really come around to his way of thinking there. I've flown a lot of hammock harnesses, the Advance Impress, and then all my X-Alp stuff, of course, doesn't have a seat board, but I think he's really correct there. I think there's, you're putting yourself at much more risk without a seat board, just because you lose a lot of that sensitivity and control over your wing. It can be pretty comfortable, but I think a seat board just makes you much more responsive to what's going on in your wing. So that's definitely a concern. The other one that Matt brought out that I hadn't thought of a ton, this is something that I think a lot of people do miss, with this whole kind of huge jump in interest in hike and fly in light gear. When we filmed 500 Miles to Nowhere, I think Nate said, and then one of his lines in there is, maybe there's like 50 people worldwide, doing bivy. That was 2014. Okay, well, so that's 10x now. There must be, that's way low. A lot of people are doing bivy now, which is really exciting. But when you just be careful, mindful, whatever you want to call it, when you move to lightweight gear, you're compromising a lot of safety. So these, like my strike harness, I have the X-Alps one, which is even, less robust than the retail one. There's not a lot of padding there. It's quote unquote certified, EN certified, but man, there's not much there. And so, you're really compromising on safety with that just lack of cushion, if you go in kind of hard, especially if you go in on your butt. So have that in mind. They're also not, the lightweight stuff is not very robust. So where we fly in the desert all the time with cactus and, prickly stuff and sage, they're just not going to get you through very much time unless you're really, really careful and really lucky. The other thing that Matt brought up that I had never thought about is that the leg buckles on a lot of pod harnesses, especially the lightweight ones, are not quick release. They don't have like buckles. They're the kind where it's like two rectangles and you slip one through the other. So they can be really hard to undo in emergencies. So if imagine going in the water when you've got one of those on, or God forbid, a river or an ocean. So really have that in mind. That's something I hadn't thought of too much, is just that they're, if you go in the water, it's really easy to get all tangled up in your line and stuff. You got to get out of that stuff really fast. And, you know, ideally you're totally unclipped before you hit the water. And so, that's another thing to keep in mind that I thought was pretty interesting. So I guess to summarize on the pod harness, you know, depending on, you know, if you're racing comps and you're serious about it, then yeah, okay, the performance does matter. If you're a B pilot, even a C pilot, and you know, you're doing smaller XC flights, you know, so, you know, under 100K kind of stuff, that fly whatever makes you most comfortable. Don't get sucked into the sexiness or whatever of a pod harness. You know, there are so many other things that you need to learn before you worry about, you know, a little better glide because of a pod harness. You know, they are warmer. That's really nice. But I mean, the advantages, I don't think, you know, they're more expensive, and there's not that many advantages really to justify jumping up until you really need that performance. And that's really only at higher level comps. So, all right, a couple final questions. Well, first one from Fabian. What about talking about the tips about heavy speed bar usage, like how to maintain the pressure without killing your legs? Also having your hands in the BC risers for long periods of time, especially when you're high and the hands are getting super cold. Yeah. So first things first, speed bar usage. A lot of harnesses don't have the right, when they come with the speed bar, for some reason, the line doesn't mesh very well with the pulley. So one thing you can do is change out the pulleys. This requires some sewing. If you can't do it, then you need to bring it to a shop. But there are a lot of pulleys that are kind of like one-way pulleys in the Harken sailing world. So I've done that quite a few times. I've changed out pulleys, so they kind of like notch. And so if you get the right diameter line, usually this is pretty big P cord, you know, like 6 mil or something, or 5 mil, and you can, you know, so as you press forward, it kind of locks it, but not too much. It doesn't lock your speed bar, but it'll take some of the pressure off that you have to push on your speed bar. The other thing is to be really, really careful with where your speed bar is set up. So if you've got like a three-step speed bar, which most of you will if you're comp flying, you know, have those three steps in the positions that are most, you know, most commonly used. So you're not between, you know, so, you know, most of the time you can just kind of go third bar, you know, maybe two thirds bar and full bar, but whatever that mix is for you. So you can kind of lock your leg out and rely skeletally instead of on your muscles, will really help. And now you should be using your speed bar quite actively. So, you know, there isn't often many times where I just can be able to park it like that. But that will definitely help. The other thing is to get comfortable with switching your legs, and this is hard to do. I often find like first step, third step will be right leg, and second step will be my left leg. But I'm just more comfortable using my right leg, so I'll often just try to do all three with one. It's not very efficient. You start diving your wing around. So go back and forth quite a bit. Another one that really helps is, I think, you know, for me, one of the things I do all the time is I press too hard on my footboard. And so on really long flights, I'm exhausting my legs for no reason whatsoever. I don't need to press on it. You know, it's not doing anything. It just makes me feel more secure or something, but it's not. And so try to get in, you know, try to remind yourself to, you know, as same with like your shoulders, like to relax, just constantly tell yourself, relax, relax, relax. And, you know, you don't need to be pressing on your your footboard. And so that will kind of help save you. So, hands cold and using the BCs. Yeah, this is tricky, especially on the lighter weight gliders. They don't give you much to grab onto. You know, they've got pretty small loops. You know, it depends on the weighing, of course, but, you know, like the Niviot Climber's got, you know, barely enough space where you can get two fingers through. So if you've got mittens on, you know, I just have to bypass those all together and just grab the B line, which isn't quite as nice. You know, the newer CCC gliders, the Enzo, the new Evox, you know, they've got nice kind of acro handles, you know, plugged right into the bees, and that's really nice. So I think you could very easily modify whatever you're flying and put a little, you know, a little 90 degree toggle in there into the bee line that you could then hold and grab hold of if it doesn't already have badger bars, which are the loops in there. So, you know, so don't be afraid of modifying gear. You know, if you've got the sewing skills, or if you don't, you can take to somebody where they can modify the gear and make it, you know, if you're flying on really cold stuff. I am not a big fan of the electric gloves. They just don't seem to work very well. You know, I'm hearing things about, you know, people carrying big battery packs on their chest and then they're running up their sleeves and battery gloves can work if you're willing to fork out the 400 euros to get them. But I think a much better solution that I saw recently with a friend of mine, local pilot, is he just wears normal gloves and then takes sleeves. And you see this in the Pakistan videos and Tom Dorlado and those guys, you know, they're taking like sleeve of down coats and kind of, you know, sewing the end where you've cut it off and, you know, and tying that on to your brakes. I think that's a mistake. I think the better thing to do is like what my buddy Charlie does, where he just makes it so he can roll it up onto his forearms and use his regular gloves when he's in flight. And then when he starts to get cold, you can just roll that sleeve back down over your hands. So you're still, you know, you've still just got the gloves underneath. I think you're still pretty dexterous, if that's the right word, where you could grab those, you know, you can grab that B line or C line or the toggles. And then, you know, and kind of go back and forth. You can roll them back down if you're, you know, if you're getting too hot. But I have heard of, you know, accidents happening on launch because those big things hanging off your brakes, you know, get wrapped up or tied, or you twist the wrong way, whatever. They get through your lines and cause a problem. So I think it's better to have those on your body to start off with and then just roll them down. So this would be a great thing to just make. I guess I'm giving an idea away there, but I should just make them and sell them on the website. But yeah, anyway, hope that is helpful. Next we have, I'm going to get my computer fired up here again. Justin, he asked a question about hike and fly. So he's a longtime rock, ice, and alpine climber. He keeps dreaming about a climb and fly adventure, but with so few hours under his belt, he doesn't feel confident in identifying a good launch site and ensuring good weather conditions for you know, big mission like that. So, you know, the obvious answer there is, you know, if you don't feel confident, don't do it. That's the easy answer there. You know, if you, coming from your climbing background and your alpine background, you know, they're the same. If you don't have the skills to, you know, to do a solid ascent and a solid descent, then you would never do it in that environment. So it's the same flying a wing, if anything's more dangerous. So, just don't do it until you have the confidence. How to get the confidence is start to do little mini versions of that wherever you are. You know, you can do little mini hike and flies and start to push out into newer sites that, you know, it's not your home hill, and start to develop those skills using all the things we talk about over and over again on the website. I mean, on the podcast, you know, from ground handling on up. He also asks, what are the pros and cons of lightweight versus full size versus ultralight versus single surface mini or speed wings for this application? Okay. So you guys have all heard me rant about speed wings, mini wings. The danger there is that they're super fast and you're flying really low to the ground, and they're very, very, very easy wings to fly. In other words, you know, you don't need a lot of skill to take a mini wing up to the top of the hill and fly it down. Accidents are just multiplying in that world, all over the world. In fact, we recently had a guest on, Benny, who said, you know, that he thinks that there's the accidents are even higher now there, maybe the one of the most dangerous things people do. It's worse there now than in base jumping and wingsuit flying. So that should be give you all like a little bit of pause. These things are killing people. So, you know, I'm not saying they're not awesome. They are super awesome, but they're really easy to fly. And so people kind of start getting too loose on them without the background and without the skills. And so, you know, I have always been a proponent of learning to paraglide first. So you get all that weather knowledge, you get the wing knowledge, you get the just so much more knowledge, but mostly you get time. It's very hard to get time speed flying, mini wing flying, because you go down so fast. So you just don't get that much time in the air. And penalties are high because you're flying low to the ground and you're flying fast and you're flying without a reserve. In most cases, you wouldn't have the time to deploy one. So, you know, that said, they're great tools for what you're talking about because they're lighter. And so you can go up, you can also fly them in maybe a little bit more wind, which can be advantageous, but they are more prone to collapse and They're more prone to, if you have a collapse, they're much harder to recover than a normal paraglider. So again, just, you know, give them respect, fly them in the right conditions and you should have, you know, no trouble. But yeah, I wish people had more respect for it. I wish it wasn't quite so cowboy like it is right now. I think we'll get through that phase and, you know, they'll be terrific. So, but lightweight and ultralight, you know, I touched on this earlier, you know, the ultralight stuff, the lightweight stuff, you are compromising on cushion. You're compromising on safety. So, it's great. It makes a sense. Awesome. But you just have to have that in mind. You know, you have got to be more conservative, more careful, because if you go in hard, we all go in hard at some point, you know, the chance for damage goes up quite a bit. Pretty excited about the whole single surface side of things. You know, somebody just flew over 100K on one of the Nivik skins. They're amazing little wings. You know, you blow on them and they inflate. They're really easy to manage. They're super easy to fly. They're incredibly light, you know, so for this application, that's a great choice because they don't fly fast like a speed wing or a mini wing. You know, they're not dynamic. They're not nearly as fun, I guess you would say. But, you know, if you just wanted to go do a mission and then come down, they're a pretty friendly glider. I still don't have my head wrapped around like thermaling in them. They don't feel like a big solid wing above your head. They feel pretty flimsy. But apparently, you know, I haven't flown them enough to really opine on this very much, but they definitely are more of a paraglider. And, you know, instead of carrying 4 or 5 kgs worth of wing and everything that comes along with that, heavy harness and everything else, you know, you can have a little webbing harness, which just weighs nothing, and a little 1.2 kg wing. So, you know, a 3-pound wing. So, you know, pretty awesome Alpine kit. So yeah, definitely something to be explored. That's all the questions I have. If you found this podcast valuable, you can support it in a lot of different ways. You can blog about it. You can post it on social media. You can talk about it on the way up to launch. You can tell your friends. What it's all about is just sharing knowledge, and or you can support it directly, and you can do that through cloudbasemayhem.com, and you can buy swag on our store, our Patagonia stuff, or our Recaps hats, which are a big hit. And I'm psyched to see people really liking those. I'm really proud to be able to represent good companies that care about the planet. And so you can buy some of that stuff, or you can just send us a one-time donation through PayPal. And by the time this is live, we should have Bitcoin and that whole stuff. I don't even understand it all, but the old cryptocurrency should be a new way for you to be able to support the show if you're into crypto. So you can get into that, or you can become a sustaining member through Patreon, patreon.com/cloudbasemayhem, and where I've set up all kinds of rewards at different levels for doing that. And you can access bonus material. I keep promising this show coming out we recorded a video presentation, a live presentation with Paul Guschelbauer when he came through town a few weeks ago. We've had a bunch of glitches with that, and it's been kind of hard to put that all together, but we will get that up. And we just did one recently with a good friend of mine, Tom Sleepin from Canada. And so I hope you enjoy that bonus content as well. But yeah, support us if you can. And if you can't, I totally understand. Like I always get a bunch of inspiration from Sam Harris when he talks about supporting the show. You know, we've decided to do it without sponsors. I think that's really important. So you know that you're coming to an authentic place with authentic information. But yeah, thanks for supporting the show. We appreciate it. And we'll see you on the next one. Cheers.